Tara Maha David. I feel like it's been so long since we've seen each other. I don't know what happened.
No. I saw you last week. Didn't I?
In my heart. It's been a long time.
Okay. Well, good to know.
We have... I know that you are excited.
You can introduce her.
Are you sure?
Because you're just going to make fun of me. The only other time I ever fangirled this hard was with Trevor Noah.
She did.
And that was really embarrassing.
She was...
Guys, I'm no Trevor Noah.
You're Trevor Noah
handsome.
Of... Well, what'd you say?
She's just as handsome.
Oh, wow. I don't know if... I think what I was going to say was nicer, but, you know, we could...
Should people keep guessing who I am?
I'm going to be formal for a moment.
Mystery guest?
Yes.
I'm going to read from the back of your book. No. But then we could we're going to look. We're going to talk.
You got to update it.
All right. So we have a really incredible guest. I feel like this was a big get for us, and I'm excited that our guest is here.
Well, I'm just going to be like really mysterious, and our guest,
Jessica Hopper. Music criticism has been included in Best Music Writing 2004, 5, 7, 10, 11, all time. Her first book, The Girl's Guide to Rocking, was named one of 2009's notable books for young readers by the American Library Association. Shout out to the ALA. She is senior editor at Pitchfork and the editor-in-chief of the Pitchfork Review. She lives in Chicago with her husband and her two sons. And I'm reading this bio from the back of an incredible collection called The First Collection of Criticism by a Living Female Rock Critic. Please, y'all.
Wow, you can't.
I can't. I'm
too excited.
I also just said I had husbands, plural.
Well, listen, I mean.
Kevin can't read. It's a well-known fact.
Let's really just blow the mythology out.
You have several husbands.
What is it, a bigamist? A polygamist?
Bigamist. Do you want two or three, though?
Well, one for the car, one for the crib.
The First Collection of Criticism by a Living Female Rock Critic. Please, y'all,
take two.
Jessica Hopper, thank you so much for being in the corner store.
Shoddy intro.
Yo, all right. So I want to let you know that we have gifts for you to share or take home.
You do have two young sons and husbands. Yo,
why? There's so... Oh, this, because there's... I see.
I have to feed them.
All right, here. These are the... I hope you like these. Yes.
Oh, you're saving the corn nuts for yourself.
No. We have another guest, right?
Oh, he gets the corn nuts. Do you like corn nuts?
All right, so we have for you, Tara. Where'd you get the?
Oh, shout out the 7-Eleven in Wicker Park.
Damn,
y'all a little expensive though.
King size.
It used to be a thrift store.
Oh, really?
Like 20 years ago, yeah.
King size double stuff Oreos. I don't know if you rock. They're vegan.
Mm. Yeah, they are vegan.
Cheetos. Flaming Hots. You're
sure.
Excited?
Yeah.
And
I've never had Flaming Hot Cheetos.
Oh,
what?
Damn. Well, here.
Wow.
This is
you have to open it now.
Yeah, this
and
is
we
Chicago
need your
tradition.
Reaction.
They're
and
very heavy.
Yeah.
It's a big bag.
Yeah, people work out with them. And then you also have honey roasted peanut munchies, which is the two for a dollar. That's pretty good. These are all delicious snacks for you, Jessica Hopper.
God, what a bounty.
Yes. So welcome. And
but wait.
Damn.
I need
There's
you to
more.
Open the bag of Flaming Hot.
Oh, yeah, please. Do you mind?
Try one.
First ever Flaming Hot.
Wow, history.
That's good radio, I feel like.
Right?
I feel like that's
sound
like
effect?
Old. Yeah. Like old school radio.
You got a crunch in the mic,
play.
Though.
That's kind of rude. I'll just kind of back away.
Okay.
That was such a good crunch. Oh, you
don't
like
displeased.
It?
Displeased by the facial expression.
Okay.
Or excited.
Oh.
Just be careful because your fingers will turn red.
Yeah. We might. We didn't provide a napkin.
That's true.
It's okay. Oh, wipe it on my hair.
I happen to be near paper towels.
Napkin provider.
Yes.
Did you guys ever have one of those like Fisher-Price tape recorders when you were little? And it would come with instructions of how to make your own radio play, but the way to make it sound like perhaps a burning fire was to crumple paper or a napkin next to the mic?
No, but that's
we could just
awesome.
Restage it.
Yeah.
Do you want to do that right? Oh.
Does that sound like a... That doesn't sound like a fire at all.
No, but I've seen movies where, you know, like, you're trying to cut out on the phone, but you can't, so you take, like, a candy wrapper and you make the crinkly sound.
Yeah, this is how all theater was
Hollywood.
Done in the day. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, Jessica, what was your... I'm
Ooh.
Glad that you like the Flaming Hots. I feel like you're really rocking
well,
with them right
words,
now.
Use your words, Jessica.
Use my words. It's kind of like... Cool Ranch, but very spicy.
Yeah. Oh, I love Cool Ranch.
But it's like fundamentally the same sort of...
Hmm.
This is very exciting, guys. You're really broadening my horizons.
I feel like it's a big moment for Flaming Hots.
Right.
I feel like, yeah.
You're going to be newly co-signed by Jessica Hoffman.
Yo, that's going to be good for them.
This is the moment like, where Cheetos finally break through. It's contingent on me.
So you're where are you from? You're not from...
I'm not from around here.
Yeah, you're not from around these parts.
Oh, I thought you were.
No. Okay.
I've been here long enough.
Yeah, okay. True.
You know?
10 years, right? Is that the...
20 this year.
Moved.
Oh.
I moved from Minneapolis.
Which is where you're from?
That's where I say I'm from, because it's a lot less embarrassing than saying I'm from Indiana.
But you,
but where?
Wait, because you're actually from Minneapolis or because you're actually from Indiana? Now I'm confused because those are two different places.
I was born and conceived in Indiana.
And what part?
Bloomington and then Peru and then some other little town. I don't... Huntington? I don't know. I left when I was little. Lived in Michigan for a little bit, but then from the time I was 7 until I was 17, I lived in Minneapolis.
Right.
So you went to school here?
I didn't go to school.
Oh, wow.
Oh, well,
we're doing this. Like,
that's awesome. Let's talk about this.
Wait, let's get to all this.
Because this guy did not go to school.
I also did not go to school. But so you, I know that in Minneapolis, you started to write, but I want to get to that point. So,
okay.
What happened first? You fell in love with the music, you fell in love with writing?
Oh, it was music. I started writing kind of by happenstance. You know, that was like I realized that like when I was probably like 7th or 8th grade, I was looking for punk rock but kind of didn't know exactly that's what I was looking for. And I was
You didn't even know it was called that.
I mean, I knew what it was, and I would hear like the Clash on classic rock radio, but like I didn't have an idea of how to access it. And I knew it was maybe something that like kids who ride skateboards are into. Like it was kind of, you know, in my own cloistered world, you know, it was like I was listening to like I was really into Tracy Chapman and Delight. And so
I love both of those artists.
But, you know, I was also like I was looking for music that was like irreverent and also had messages. And that's why I was listening to those things, though. I mean, you know, great albums. And then in ninth grade, like a couple days into ninth grade, I was sitting out gym, like sitting on the bleachers at gym, just like being like, I'm not going to do gym. And this other weirdo kid came up to me and was like, are you a hippie or a punk rocker? And I was like, neither, both, I don't know. And he was like, well, I'm going to make you a tape. And his brother had like, you know, like a really incredible record collection. And then he comes back to school like 2 days later with this tape. And it wasn't like just starting with like, oh, the Sex Pistols or like some other like kind of like starter punk band. It was like, you know, Big Black and the Butthole Surfers and the Boredoms and Babes in Twilight. I mean, the entire first side, the funny thing about it is like clearly like his brother, he got like stuck in the bees. and it was stuff that was like pretty mature, deep quality catalog punk and independent rock. And this is like 1990. And so it was like a choice period to be jumping in there. And he gave me a tape and I was like, holy crap. That's what I'll say on the radio.
You could swear.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is a podcast.
It's not
this
live.
Is, yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Or on the radio.
Yeah, no, literally
it, you
no
know,
one cares.
It was like putting on my shitty little Walkman and just listening to stuff that was like, you know, it didn't start with like the poppy Sonic Youth song. It was like the Sonic Youth song that had like a minute of noise in the middle. And I was like, yeah, that's what I'm looking for. And so,
and you knew it when you heard it. You
as
knew
as soon as I heard it that I was like, "Oh, this is what I'm into. This is who I am. My identity is whatever these people are. Got to find out how these people dress. Got to go buy like a magazine. Look up how to dress."
What was going on around you that you knew you needed an alternate reality?
I mean, you know, at that, if we're talking about, you know, Midwest America, 1990, we're talking about. You know, you could find out about some okay things through, say, MTV, but there were, I mean, it was like MTV and The Box was basically how I found out about hip hop, particularly The Box. Shout out The Box.
Shout
forever.
Out The Box.
Shout out The
forever.
Box.
Forever. Oh my God.
before me.
It was like where you had to call in and when you called in.
I've heard of it, but it
charged money back to your parents' landline.
Nice.
Always sus.
But it was always
with moms. Moms was like, "What
Wait,
is
so
this?
Where would it air?"
It was a cable channel that was like request only, and it was like all the nasty videos that they couldn't play on MTV.
Nice.
True Live Crew.
My mom wouldn't let me watch MTV, so I was
Rex and Effects was like constantly on because it's got the lady in the bikini with the saxophone.
A lot of rump shaking.
Oh yeah, it was like a lot of things that was like so far from Minneapolis, like West Coast. You know, gangster rap, and like we're all in the same gang, like stuff like that. Where I was like, "Who are all these people? Where do I get their music? What is this?" Mm-hmm. It was something that was very, you know, different from my life, and so it was like I definitely knew about music that way, but it wasn't the same for me as like when I heard punk rock, and immediately I was like, I wanted to be really part of that, but it was like the broader culture was, you know. All there was mainstream culture, you know, and that you really had to dig to find something that was meaningful. And it was like you had to go to a record store, maybe like a magazine shop. I feel like I'm talking about buggy whips. This is so
right.
old-fashioned.
Yeah. But what incredible public spaces to venture as a young person to get lost and discover.
It was like there was this little thing that was like literally like a Jamaican things store by my house, which is like, okay, just keep in mind Minnesota in 1990, it was still literally the whitest state in America, which having North Dakota beat is like really saying something.
Really?
Yes.
Very
and so
white,
it was like,
like.
Is it because the population though?
I mean, it changed, and we got a lot of people from Chicago by the mid 1990s.
And now a lot of Somalians and Minnesota's
is like
different.
The way that Minnesota is like a rich culture today, it really wasn't when I was younger.
Been.
Go up,
yeah,
take a visit.
Yeah.
Too cold
pop
right
up.
Now, but maybe
well,
in the
fair.
Summer.
Yeah, springtime.
Yeah, it's like Evanston, but like bigger.
Mm.
It's like a big Evanston. Kind
so
of.
Did you?
But so I would go to this gym, like the Jamaican store sold like kind of like Jamaican things and then some weird clothes and then some magazines. They stocked Spin. And I would go in and be like, oh, this is like cool stuff. I wouldn't like, you know, but it wasn't like anything I could do or buy or wear or anything. And I would also do this at like the skate shop around the corner, the Alt, shout out the Alt, still there. And I would just go and like look at the things and try to kind of figure out, like, is this a thing I can get into? Is this a thing I can get into? But like kind of the only thing I had money for, like babysitting money for, was like Spin, or you know some other kind of music magazines that were happening at the time. And so I was just sort of piecing things together. But you know the rest of it kind of came from at the time there was you know four or five free music publications in town that just wrote about music that were free. And so I could get a lot of information that way.
Where would you listen to the music, though? Because you'd be reading it, which is one thing. Did the Jamaican store also have...
They didn't have any, like, ska cassettes
records
or anything.
Or nothing.
I mean, eventually, I mean, most all of my first tapes and stuff came from friends. Yeah. You know, it was really about, like, dubbing stuff for your friends or, you know, so it was, like, for... That first year I really lived on, I had most of Sonic Youth Daydream Nation on one side of a cassette and then most of 3 Feet High and Rising on the other side. And it wasn't until I bought those on CD. I was like, these albums are like 5 songs longer. This is like a revelation. But that was like my taking the bus to school tape. And, you know, like as I accrued more babysitting money, you know, I got a couple more tapes here and there. And then like... and then my first job, my first proper job that wasn't delivering papers was I tried to intern at the record store and they felt bad for me and they gave me a job.
That's very
nice
of them.
So did you change how you dressed?
Yeah, I went super grunge. I located.
So like what does that mean? Like plaid, like the plaid shirt?
Oh, yeah.
Shirt and then
oh, my God.
This is 90. This is the era.
Yeah.
This was
when you were 8, though.
What?
You started listening to this stuff when you were 8?
No.
Okay. You said you were in the bleachers. How old were you?
I was in ninth grade.
Oh, you were in ninth grade. Yeah. I thought you said you were 8 years old. I was like, damn.
Really? I was 10 and carrying a chain
butthole
wallet.
Surfers.
I was OG
I know.
Grunge.
I was
the original grunge.
I had
grunge.
A pacifier and a Dead Kennedys record.
Talk about OG.
No. So I was like 9th or 10th grade.
Okay.
You know, when this started to happen, and I went to like the store in town that sold Doc Martens, and I saved up my money and I got some Doc Martens, mm-hmm. and I saved up my money and I got my chain wallet.
Hey! Shout out
chain wallet.
Yeah. There's still a look.
They're a look. We'll say that.
It's not my look anymore.
Yeah, not a chain wallet, but a chain. You can get a chain.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Two of them.
And so that was like a plaid flannel. And then like a Mudhoney t-shirt or like a Nirvana t-shirt that I mail ordered these things.
Mm.
And then I started going to concerts.
Because y'all didn't have Hot Topic.
We didn't have. No. Hot Topic was not quite yet a thing.
I know.
And also, here's the other thing, is that T-shirts back then only came in, everything was like a, you know, a beefy tees L. Right. And I'm you know, at the time I'm weighing maybe 92 pounds. And so they were like basically dresses, like tunics that I could belt. I was tucking them in, guys. It was grunge was a hard time.
Yeah.
And then I would wear baby barrettes in my hair. So that was
cute.
My look.
Yeah.
I
fuck
like
with
that.
The baby
barrettes.
Yeah.
I like that look.
Well, what about makeup?
No.
No makeup.
No, okay. Man.
True.
Women in grunge, you were just trying to look
like
a boy.
Well, so there's like grunge, but there's punk rock. So when
And definitely
those
that
two,
was like,
yeah.
But also it was like, and then pretty soon, within like a few months of getting into punk rock, and kind of right when I was about ready to give up on it, because I was going to these shows and it was like, hardcore matinees and guys in like tearaway track pants doing these like jumps.
Listen,
like,
I'm wearing tearaway track pants.
But it was like, that was like a moment in hardcore. And I was like, this is not the thing that I want.
Local cats. These are folks.
Yeah. They were like just shitty local Minneapolis bands generally.
Yeah.
But it was like, that was who was playing all ages shows. And it was kind of like the tail end of this kind of macho hardcore thing. And that was like right at that moment, somebody that I worked with at the record store said, you know, I'm booking this tour for this band Bikini Kill, and I think you'd really like them. Here's this tape. And it was like, dun dun dun, feminist punk rock is a thing. Oh my God, this is the actual thing I'm looking for. And that was like, that's basically how we get to here.
Yeah. So but before you
go back to the tearaway track pants.
No. Yeah, right, because it's
speak,
a look
speak
again.
More on that. Because you played music.
Terribly, yeah.
But you, so was that your kind of initial impetus? Is like, I'm listening to this music, now I'm going to play it? Because I feel like,
I mean, that was kind of it. I didn't think I could do it until I saw this band Babes in Toyland, and it was like, that was the first time I saw women on stage, and they were like, you know, so loud, so furious, so everything, and it was constantly sort of, things were being revealed to me that I was like, oh, that's the thing I'm here for. And as I dug deeper, because it was like once I got into punk rock and kind of found like avenues to find out about things, and I was so curious, I was really looking for, as I found more things that spoke to me, it made me dig deeper and like harder. And that was really, if you loved something, that was really, I mean, it meant going through like starting at the A's in the record store and going through the bins and being like, oh, there's girls on the back of this record. I mean, it was like, that was.
And even from that young, you knew that you were looking for women who made this kind of music.
Yes. Once I realized that women made punk rock, because that was, you know, that wasn't what was necessarily introduced to me. And I was still interested in that, but it was like, until I saw something that was kind of speaking to, I don't want to say speaking to my experience, but it was like, until you see it, you can't be it, or like whatever.
Yeah, and you see yourself in it too, so it becomes a...
And I started a band the next day with my friend, and we were screaming lyrics out of like Sassy Magazine, and...
What was the name of the band? Yeah, what was the name of the band?
God, I don't even know. But then like my later high
You're
school...
You're lying.
Band. No. The first time, I don't know. It was like probably like a... It was something et. It ended with an et. I don't even remember. But then I was in I think my first band I played a show with was called Plaster.
It's not that bad.
Did you sing or did you play an instrument?
Bass, right?
I played guitar and then I moved to bass.
Thank you.
Let me describe for the listeners at home. Someone's basically playing like a imaginary fretless bass in here. I'm not going to name who it is.
Tara. It's not me. God.
Snitch, man. Both y'all. Snitching.
Yeah, that's true.
So that was your first, because I feel like listening to hip hop, my first impetus was to break dance and then rap, and thankfully I found other venues and vehicles for my creativity. But your first was to play the music, to make the music.
And trying to be in a band when you're a teenager is like pretty difficult anyways, and played some shows, but it was like I kind of wound up being in, because I wanted to try to be like serious about it, I wound up being in bands with grown-ups. Also, grown-ups had cars. And
what do you mean grown-up?
Like people who were in their 20s. Mm. And I was in like 9th and 10th grade. I'm playing in like bar bands.
And going to bars, going to clubs. So, in some ways, even some of your recent work and in conversation talks about those situations, being a young person.
I mean, it was, those were absolutely formative. I mean, that's like my, seeing Babes in Toyland was like my, that's like the Rosetta Stone of my work, you know? Mm. That it's sort of this one moment was so powerful that it's like, 26 years later, and I'm still talking about it because it was an evangelizing about like the power of seeing something you identify with up on a stage under stage lights, you know, speaking to something that is within you that maybe you can or cannot name yet, you know? I mean, that's like huge.
Yeah. At what point then do you begin to think about How does writing enter the
Well,
your
I mean,
space?
it has to do with that same band. So, these local music publications were writing about this band, Babes in Toyland, which was three women, and they were sort of, they had a record out, and they were kind of, blowing up in the relative terms of Minneapolis 1990, but starting to be a band that people were like psyched on and writing about a lot. And I really didn't like the way that they were written about, and it was sort of. People would just be like, they're amateur and they're screamy and they're like this and they're like that. And I was like, but that's like everything I'd read about punk rock. And at that point, you know, I read as much about it as I knew, because it was like, how did you accumulate music? So it was like, you know, I would go to the record store and like read about things in the magazines and like put them back, you know, because I didn't have that many or whatever. And I was like, so I was learning history. And I was like, but isn't that like why we like punk rock? Is because it's amateur and screamy and like kind of
lo-fi
and that it's very visceral.
Yeah.
And that was why it was potent to me. And people are saying, well, kind of being like dismissive of that music for those reasons. And I was like, but you don't understand. That's like, I'm like the number one true fan, like, you know, basically like in the pit with a giant number one foam finger, you know, like, and so I called this local magazine and I left them a message on their answering machine. And I was like, hi, I want to write for your magazine. And, you got this article wrong. I'd like to offer my corrective.
And for real said that on the message?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was like, why don't you call me back? And then they called me back. And the woman who you know, called back and talked to me and like took the message.
How old are you when you're making this phone call?
I'm in 9th grade.
Boss!
Yeah, that's pretty...
You know, I don't know if it was so much that I had like self-confidence, but it was like, I just didn't know like, well, why wouldn't I?
Right.
You know what
That's
I mean?
That's like a kid thing.
It was kind of a kid thing, but also as a Montessori kid. And so it was like everything you learn by doing, but also you learn by like failing, you know? Mm. And so it was just sort of like instilled in me, like you learn by doing. And so I called and whatever. And they were like, have you ever written before? And I was like, yeah, school papers. Like, sure, man. All the time. Homework. Probably write more than you. But so
I love that the stance is like, I'm going to talk trash to you, even though you call me back.
but the woman who called me back is now, you know, she'd been my friend basically since then.
So. Still.
Yeah. We're still friends.
Amazing. Love that.
But that eventually they were like, no. And I was like, well, fuck you then. And I'm going to go start a fanzine because I knew what fanzines were. And so I started publishing my own little magazine, be like, I'm going to write about this band and I don't care. And like, whatever. And then made a fanzine.
I did that too.
And then I wound up working at that magazine.
Hey.
I made them give me a column.
You made them?
I made them. But yeah, so and eventually it was like, wrote about that band a bunch. Not very well, but like, you know, that was kind of how it started. It was like, no one's gonna put me on. I will put myself on.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. And when did it click for you that you, I mean, when did you know that writing was going to be your primary vehicle?
I don't know, like 10 years later.
Uh-huh. Mm. So from that time to 10 years later, who were you? What were you doing?
So, I mean, I started writing and I loved making a fanzine and it got really good response. And I think it because I was sort of, 16's real like good spot for that like nice kill your idols kind of vibe, you know, just kind of brutal takedowns of people that might be too sacred for other people who were like in the music press at the time or whatever. But also that was like I was giddy and I was excited. And so people started... people started hiring me to write for like the local paper and other magazines. And that was like what I was doing in like 10th grade. And it gave me an identity and a purpose and a way to be in community with people.
A little bit of bread?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like a little bit.
Yeah. No more babysitting or we're still babysitting?
No. I worked at the record store.
Yeah.
Okay. What did your parents think?
I have a very visceral memory of my dad picking me up from the Kinko's with my boxes of freshly Xeroxed fanzines, and it fell open to a page where one of my friends had laid out a page and inserted all these pictures from like how to put on a condom, and it was like an interview with a band. I can't imagine what that band thought. Like, there's all these pictures of dicks, like drawings of dicks in there.
Dick pics.
But yeah, but it was like, it was like instructions for putting on a condom that was like taking up the entire page, and it just like, you know, basically flipped open, and my dad looks down from the driver's seat, and he's like, and I just saw my dad just change color. He's like, "What is this you're distributing?" You know, but my mom was a journalist. Managing editor at a paper. But
what did she write about though?
I mean, but she was an editor, so she was like making like the Sunday Style section or something. But at that point, my dad was a prosecuting attorney. He prosecutes cold cases, DNA cold cases. Like he should come on your show.
That's
very
intense.
Yeah,
like prosecuting like 30-year-old rapes.
That's wild.
He's amazing.
How?
DNA. It's a DNA.
Expert. Right, but it's just like,
yeah.
It's so still, cold. Yeah. It's so
that's
cold.
That's still magic.
Yeah. But so you know, I think when I was a grown-up, my dad said to me, like, we just kind of left you alone because it seemed like that's you were happiest doing your own thing. So it was like, I didn't even tell my parents. I was be like, Mom, Dad, I'm going to start a magazine. It was like, pick me up from Kinko's. I have 300 fanzines and I can't carry them home. And it was kind of like that.
You would distribute them to homies. You would go to shows.
Yeah.
You'd give them away. You'd sell them.
Yeah. And it was like from the second one on, it was internationally distributed.
Hey, that's dope.
But that was like, I mean, there was a real, that was how.
So you like mail them to friends or something?
I would mail them to friends. I'd run off like 300 and then you would.
Original hustle.
You would send them to fanzines. Other fanzines would write about them or whatever. And then people would send you like $2 or a self-addressed stamp envelope or like whatever you required. And then you did a lot of trading. But people would send me like $2. People send you a check for $2.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
You ever get like a bunch of coins?
Yes. You would get like taped together coins.
But you also were kind of building this larger community.
Yes. So to get away from like the specifics of
the economy. And then a stamp rose from 27 cents to 32.
Yeah. When it was like, it cost me 53 cents to mail it.
See, you made a profit.
So I made like, so depending on how much it
Get that bag.
Right? No. Secure the bag in 1990.
But it got a lot cheaper when I stole my Kinko's key card.
Wow.
Allegedly. I don't know if statute of limitations.
No, but it was like,
I don't want your dad to cold crack open the case. Okay, look, I don't know.
In a different state? I don't know.
Look, I don't.
But it was like, you know, but that was, but it was like the guys and the band who worked at the Kinko's. They're like, my band's playing. They'd slip you a flyer. You would like put it in the fanzine. You get the hookup.
Okay.
I mean, like, it's always
it's
been
all
that
working
way.
Together.
It's always been that way.
Well, and it's also about, because I'm wondering if you're, because you're getting the tapes through some friends.
Yeah. So it was like, I was going to shows and writing about local bands but really it was like kind of the part of the story that I'm leaving out here. Part of the reason I wanted to start a fanzine and do that is I remember hearing like two guys who were real kind of like stalwarts of the scene, standing by the door of a venue talking shit about a guy, just saying like, oh, he only goes to shows, meaning like he doesn't participate. He's not in a band. He doesn't put up bands. Yeah. He doesn't contribute. And the thing was, is it was really clear to me by example of everybody that I was around that like if I wanted to be part of this thing, I had to really contribute and be part of it and not just sort of a passive consumer of it. Is like, you know, obviously I wasn't going to put bands up in my parents' house or whatever, but it was like I was in a band. I did a fanzine. I worked on other people's fanzines. I went, you know, really like support your scene. Air quotes or whatever, but it was like that was absolutely what you did because it was so tiny and there was no internet, and that was like it was how you got information, it was how you connected with people, it was how you just kind of were part of the dialogue, and you went to go see bands that you didn't like because it was like there wasn't anything quite like the developed touring scene that there is now. We had one, maybe two all ages shows a week. And you just went because it was, A, all there was to do. Mm. And that, secondly, it was like where you saw your friends and whatever. But it was like, that was how you kept these things alive. Because you would go there when no one came to the show and you're like, seven people are here. Like, I want this band to come back. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I just want us to also collectively take that note, the importance of the weekly, regular, all ages show, venue. Do you know what I mean? I think we need to kind of just remind ourselves in Chicago, like, it's a good note.
The other thing, too, is, like, it's a way that people can really have it, not to be too unrealistically, like, altruistic about it or whatever, but it's, like, not about, like, a booze economy, you know? And it's really about showing young people that there's a place for them in this and that they can participate in it rather than, and you know, this is like no shade to the Metro or someplace like that where there's like a barrier. It's like at those shows like that, it was like, you know, one of the first people that I ever gave a copy of my fanzine to was Mac from Supertrunk. And then it was like a couple years later, he was buying ads in my fanzine. A couple years after that, I was like doing PR for that label. You know, a couple years later, it's like I still, you know, find ways to like work with, collaborate, go to their shows, like whatever, with some of these people that when I was a teenager, I was one of 20 people at their shows, mm-hmm. you know? So it really did prove to me about, you know, that community is like a real and lasting thing that you can find in music but that's what sustains it. You know, mm-hmm. that was what was modeled to me. And that's what I hope to like perpetuate, you know?
Yeah. That's beautiful.
That reflects here, too.
Absolutely.
You know?
And even in the day, too. I mean, the equivalent in some ways in Chicago is house music, you know, is young people just gathering in small spaces to be commune mm-hmm. with one another and then listen to a DJ that was essentially like that, you know, god and goddess to
records. You know, hearing about, I interviewed DJ Rashad like years ago and talking about like, oh, and we just came up through these roller skating parties. Right. You know, I think the importance of all ages avenues I think this also has particular resonance for right now. It's like places where people can go, be indoors, be in community, be someplace that's safe in a lot of different ways. I mean, all the ways that we talk about being safe, you know? And so I think that's part of the reason that all ages is so important.
That's what I don't know if you know the good homie Boogie McLaren. She talks about that a lot and the maintenance of that in the house scene and how now we miss those spaces. And, you know, I think one of the hopes is that Boogie wants to bring back the all ages house parties to, you know, maintain safe spaces for young people across the city.
How else can people really develop their creativity other than in like total isolation? And then you put it out on the internet and either it pops or it doesn't or like whatever, you know what I mean? Like, or that you have to I mean, honing those things in real time.
Yeah.
You know, that's how you get to be a good DJ, is by failing miserably with, like, your bad ideas.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Or whatever.
I mean, I guess any art, any craft.
Well, and that's why I think, like, the YCA open mic is important, and we need more and more spaces like
that. I was
going
to say
like
it, but I was...
No, it's facts, but yeah. it's facts.
No, you're right.
You know, we want to get you out to the YCA open mic, by the way.
Oh,
every
yeah,
Tuesday
for
night.
Sure.
We'll do that another time. So what was a big break for you then at that point that, you know, took you from the, you know, the self-published zine into a space where you're like, I am going to make a career out of this?
Well, career part didn't come for a long time. I mean, it was sort of, I got into doing, like, working at little record labels and stuff. And
while you were
PR.
Still in Minneapolis.
Yeah. Well, I was kind of, that was like, I would do like summer internships in a mailroom, you know, lick some stamps all summer.
You really love mailing.
Put that out
she was
good at it.
I was super good at it. If anyone ever mail ordered a Helmet record in like the early 90s, I probably packed and shipped it to you. Shout out to New Metal Progenitors Helmet.
I don't even know what that is, but it's not funny.
You don't need to know. But that I wanted to just do anything I could to work with music, and so I did that. And then, you know, I wrote for local things and, you know, that kind of thing. And then when I graduated from high school, I moved out to Los Angeles, and then shortly after I did that, I started writing for Spin magazine. It was a little short-lived. I gave the Rolling Stones like a scathing review. Like, this is like late period.
Great.
Rolling Stones, and it was such a fallout. I mean, like, in a way that I didn't understand until much later, but it was like a straight up kerfluffle.
And so I only did
a couple reviews for them, but it was like some of my first paychecks that were more than $35 for writing something and really having someone edit my stuff. And it was, you know, editors who believed in me and sort of plucked me up from fanzine obscurity. And I wrote for Grand Royal a little bit.
Yeah.
Wait, so you moved out there to write?
I moved out there because I thought that's where you had to go to work with music. And also, I literally had like every single job with music in Minneapolis by the time I was out of high school. Mm. So I was like, needed to broaden my horizons. And I was out there for a few years. And then the big all ages venue out there that I was really like in the community of, a place called Jabberjaw, shut down. And I had started doing PR for bands and record labels. And also, you know, it started my fan. I was still doing my fanzine. And
what was it called, your fanzine?
Hit It or Quit It.
Hit It or Quit It.
Hey, yeah. I fuck with that.
Good.
Sorry.
So to speak. Like,
So I was out there and I was like working in music, and I was like, you know, all my music jobs spanned from like, you know, cleaning the office after hours of like guys that worked in music publishing, because like I understood how to like match CDs to their cases by like the little numbers on the inside and stuff. I had all these like kind of random jobs, and I was doing PR, and I was like,
but what does PR look like back then? Like
calling people on the phone. I also would send them a fax if I reached their voicemail. There was like maybe 40 people who had email, and you would write an email. Like, it wasn't even like some copy and paste. It was like literally manually writing like hundreds of emails.
So then you came to Chicago. What was
I started doing PR independently with like bands and record labels. And the first Chicago band I worked with was a band called Trenchmouth, which was, most people know that as Fred Armisen's band, pre-Saturday Night Live.
Wow. Yeah.
But anyways, but they were an awesome Chicago band. But so I started working with these independent bands, and the people that I knew in the music scene out there who weren't part of like the all ages, super tiny independent music scene would be like, well, what label do you want to work at? And I was like, I don't want to work at a label. And they're like, well, don't you want to like, and there was kind of only one path for like professionalism. And I was starting to work with all these Chicago and Wisconsin and DC bands, and like a bunch of Chicago bands, Joan of Arc and Promise Ring was kind of a Chicago band. And
this is in the mid-aughts? This is
94, 95, 96, 97, probably properly.
You're still in LA.
Yeah, so I was in LA for about 3 years. So I'm like 21 at this point. And then I moved out here. I came on a trip out here, and I met a lot of people who were doing what I was doing and thinking about music, how I was thinking about music. And I came out here and I moved right by where you guys are.
Oh, yeah.
I like the other side of the block.
Oh,
that was my first apartment.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, what is that street? Thomas?
Yeah.
Mm. I was right there.
So Wicker Park in the 90s, late 90s.
It was a different kind of place.
Yeah, very. And so what were some of yours? Because there were also some good places to listen to music. You'd go to some of the...
I was old enough to get into the Empty Bottle without a fake ID by the time I moved here. That's sort of the turning point.
It's important. Yeah.
It's been around that long?
Oh, yeah. 35 years, maybe?
First time I ever snuck into a bar was as a teenager moving to L.A., friend snuck me into the Empty Bottle. I like drove through Chicago on my way there.
Allegedly.
Right. Bruce, you're not listening, are you? So I mostly go to the Empty Bottle, but really my home was the Fireside.
Yeah.
Is that still around?
Yeah. The bowl. I don't think they do music in the same way. Yeah.
Not in the same way.
It's a bowling alley. And they had
but it used
punk
to be
rock
like
shows. And
some on the weekends they would have like three shows a day.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah, Empty Bottle is a little grungy for me.
We're going there tonight, so put on your...
Wearing snap pants. Is that grungy? No, that's hardcore.
Just tell people you're bringing hardcore back with your tearaway track pants.
Right. That's right.
Do some, what is it where you jump and you touch your toe? What is that?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's called gymnastics. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not really sure. But that's a great moment for music in Chicago, too. And I also lived in Wicker Park at that moment. And so all those places you were running around and Milwaukee Avenue and North Ave.
You wouldn't go up to Wicker Park after about 9 unless you had to. Unless you're going to like Earwax to return your movies.
Nice. Yes.
Wow, Kevin's really.
I know. No, this is memory lane. Look. Yeah.
No, this is actually where like a lot of segue. A lot of what my next book is about Wicker Park, kind of a little bit later than that, at the period of where it really starts to transition.
Wow, y'all got sister books.
That's what my next book is about. Is about Wicker Park in the 90s and change.
Oh, we should do it like a... Do you remember like sometimes you could have like a choose your own adventure chapter book where like one side would be facing one way and then you flip the book over and like it's facing the other way?
Yeah.
Why don't we do that?
We should do... Okay. I love that book.
Okay.
I don't
hold me to it, but sure.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. It's a good idea for now.
We're going to go back talking about stamps and pre-internet, but that's basically...
Yeah.
But that it was like, I try to tell people there was a time where I moved out of Wicker Park because... people shot through our house and then we watched these people walk down the street and light all the cars in the what's the liquor store that was at Division and Damon right there?
Oh, is it still there?
In the little strip mall next to like what was
still there.
The old video store, and now there's like a bank in the middle of it. But there was a video store, and now it's like a lingerie store, maybe something else now.
I don't remember.
Yeah, it was like at one point they were selling, I think,
isn't
tuxedos.
Isn't that a Chase Bank now?
No, it will. There is a bank. No, it's across the street from
okay,
there.
Okay, but so anyways, I was in my apartment there. I lived about a block away from like where the Rainbow is.
And also where the old YCA, we were at 2049 West Division.
I lived down the street.
Yeah, wow. I think I was like 1941.
Yep. Oh yeah.
Division.
Yeah.
And
I
remember
the year for a second.
I'm like, yep, I was just like, whoa,
old.
Okay, we went back.
Studs Terkel. No. And I remember we just heard this sound. It was like breaking glass. It just kept coming closer and closer. And it was these two dudes walking down the street. And they're breaking out the window of every car they pass that was parked. And then they walked to the like Division and Damon liquor store and lit all the cars in the parking lot on fire.
It's like a Molotov cocktails.
And it was like, but that was like Wicker Park
in the day.
Wicker Park, 1997, 1998. And I was like,
crazy.
This is a little bit a lot for me.
Yeah.
Intense.
So it's different now, but it was sort of, I read about living there kind of after that time.
Wow. All right. Well, I really want to compare
notes.
Yeah,
it's going to be, I'm going to read both of y'all's books like side by side. You know?
Yeah, that'd be...
Who's more gritty? Who's more real?
Well, not
let, so can we talk about this book that I'm...
Yeah, guys, we're already up to me being 25. I'm 41.
Wow.
How much
okay,
time
we got 16
have?
More years.
Well, you have to 11:30.
I want to talk about the Chief Keef one.
Okay, yeah.
Because that's such a moment, you know?
All right, so should we explain slightly what my book is that you're waving?
Please, yeah.
Okay. They can't see this?
Okay, it's a... the book that came out in 2015, the first collection of criticism by a living female rock critic.
The intro is beautiful.
The intro is beautiful.
I felt that.
I have a question about
so
the intro.
Much, though.
So it's just in case anyone hasn't deduced what we're talking about, this is this book is kind of an anthology of my writing from about 2003, 2004 until approximately 2014.
This one's 2002. Hit it or quit it, number 17.
All right. Oh, well, shit.
The intro.
I didn't know that was, that's your fanzine. That's dope. No, I really...
And the thing that you say, even the note that precedes the introduction, is the title of the book is not entirely accurate.
The title is
The First Collection of Criticism by a Living Female Rock Critic. So explain what you mean by that and also why you titled it that beautiful and brilliant title.
It was kind of the joke title. And I said it to Tim Kinsella, who is my publisher at Featherproof. And he's like, well, that's what we have to call it. And I was like, I don't know. And he's like, nope, holding you to it. And I was like, I don't know. But it was when I was, I did my first book, which is for, excuse me. I did my first book in 2008 or 2009. And it's like a, kind of like a how-to book for young women that want to, or just any young person that wants to get into music, but it's called The Girl's Guide to Rocking. And so it's sort of specifically, aiming towards that and, empowering young women to pick up a guitar or something. And after that book, people were definitely asking me, like, well, when are you going to put out something that's like your music criticism? When are you going to put out like stuff that's like old Hit or Quit It's or Punk Planet columns? And I'd written for all these different places over the years. I mean, I've been freelance for 15 years or something. Hold on one second.
It's all right.
It's okay. And so my work was kind of everywhere, and I'd been writing a lot because I was trying to make a living.
Right. The freelance
and so
hustle.
Yeah,
right.
The hustle. Yeah, hustled for decades.
Also, shout out Punk Planet and Miss Punk Planet. And
Me too.
Shout out Dan and the whole squad.
I know.
Yeah.
And people would say, when are you going to put these things together? And I talked about it with some people over the years, but like nothing had come together. And then after my first book, there was definitely people who are sort of interested in being like, within, the publishing world, being like, well, what do you want to do for your next book? And I would say, well, I want an anthology of my criticism because I think it would do really well. I think the time's right. I think it's important. And like one doesn't exist. And as soon as you say something like doesn't exist, or whatever, people are just like, well, there basically has to be like a path already. There has to be a thing that exists. And it's like, there's so few music books that make it to publication that are by women but any man who's an established critic or even not a particularly established critic might have multiple anthologies of their work. And at that time, I had a bunch of my work appear in like Best Music Writing, like over and over. I mean, I'm tied, because I am petty and I count. I'm tied with Robert Christgau and Grail Marcus for the most appearances in that series. And like,
you ran the decade. I mean,
and that mattered to me. And I'd be like, but no, like for real, people take me seriously. I take me seriously. And even though I think I'm sort of like in a weird way, like the Anthony Bourdain of music criticism, where it's like, I'm not the best chef, but if you know about one chef, you probably know about me. Mm-hmm. Like that doesn't mean I shouldn't have a book, whatever. But all these people are telling me like, no, you can't have a book. I'd be like, but what about Chuck Klosterman? What about like all these other people? But their example of what I could be was so gendered that it was like, well, no other woman has done this or whatever. People didn't know about it. I was like, but there have been all these women who came before me and all their books are out of print. All their books are genius. And like, and so I don't want to say like I gave into the title, but it was like, for any woman coming up behind me or anybody that's sort of like working off this example or whatever, I want there to be something so firmly in the ground that you can't say there's no precedent.
Yeah.
Because that's what people were telling me about the books that mattered to me, that like basically they didn't exist or like they didn't count.
Well, one of the things that I enjoyed about reading this book was also watching on YouTube a talk you gave, I feel like in Australia.
Yeah, Big Sound.
Yeah, it was a keynote address, and it was beautiful.
Ooh, I didn't see that.
And it
it's me crying behind a podium in front of like 600 people. It's pretty intense.
In part because you're recounting some of the horrors and difficulty of existing in the male space of music industry patriarchy and misogyny.
It's
a brave and brilliant account because you're also pulling in a lot of real time resources. I think you sent out a tweet that began the process of collecting stories from women in the industry, and so to read it accompanied with this anthology is a testament to your brilliance, perseverance, and courage. And
thank you.
I also wonder in this moment. I feel like because this is now a few years ago, but we're in the moment we're in now. What is some of your, some of what it seems is happening and what you addressed 2 years ago is beginning to at least come to light. And I think that part of you being vocal is part of the tipping point.
Well, thank you. I think I think sometimes when I really think about like that year and also that talk where it was like that wasn't the talk I was planning to give, that was like literally the talk that came out, and in part because when I went down to Australia, I was talking to some women there, and I didn't really know about this festival, and I didn't know a lot about what was happening in Australia, and generally people were having me come around and to kind of give a talk about. You know, rape, but I'm happy the entire working life. Mm. Every panel I've ever been on, but I'm happy the entire working life. Mm. Every panel I've ever been on, but I'm happy to do it when asked, of course. And I went down there and these women were telling me, oh, we're so glad you're here. You know, there's this thing going on in the scene here where in the last couple months, women have been getting drugged and raped at the punk pop shows, and no one knows what's happening and no one knows how to stop it, and so everybody's really scared.
That's crazy.
And I was like, okay, so you know, I go back to my hotel, I'm like jet lagged and kind of crazy, and I was like, all right, let's do it. Like, and I scrapped my speech and I just started making notes. Everything that I had written, I mean, I wrote it on the plane, but, you know, it was not like it was like, you know, some masterpiece. And then I just
But it is, though.
But so then I get there and the night before I just start making these notes and I was like, I hope this is enough to fill the time. They want me to speak for about 45 minutes and I speak for about 25 minutes. And then I was like, I'm turning the floor over because people here need to talk. Because if this is what's going on, like people need to talk about it.
Well, what happened?
I mean, the whole thing is like burned in my brain, even though, I mean, it's like, I can't watch that video because it's like,
but did it get better in the scene over there?
I don't know. But in this moment, one of the first questions was a guy, you know, standing up, because basically where I go with it is like, you know, basically say, men have to stop this. Because if women could fix this, we would have a long time ago. Or, you know, not just women, obviously, but like, you know, it's been such a space of victimization for anyone who's vulnerable. That means people who are young, black and brown kids, queer women, you know, anybody that isn't basically, you know, cishet white men is routinely victimized within those music spaces. And so that's what I was saying is like, you know, you basically have to call your bros into account. You have to believe women. You have to stop this stuff. It can't be like, oh, this is just what happens in this space. And one of the first people to get up and talk about it was a guy who said, actually, I did this recently as I confronted another man. And he breaks down crying about like how in so many ways it was just so, excuse me, he breaks down, you know, becomes very emotional that just it's against everything he'd ever been taught, basically, was to confront another man about his behavior. You can't act like this. You can't touch that woman. You got to get out of here. I'm going to take you out of here. And took him out of this space and talked to him. And I mean, people were in tears. I was already in tears, but it was there was a lot of very emotional sharing. And we just let the mic go around the room. And it's like, you know, 600 people in the room, whatever.
And the camera runs. It's like 58 yeah. minutes or so, and it's
that's
worth
crazy.
Watching.
And but it was like, and it was a woman talking about how she had studied with someone who was like a virtuoso at this particular instrument. She had studied with him for years, and he had sexually assaulted her, and then tried to, I think, buy her off with a guitar, a very fancy instrument, and she had quit music for years. But this was like her. She decided she was going to come back to music, and this was like the first thing she came back to. I mean, I don't know. I'm like ready to start yeah. crying talking about it. But it was like really, it was really, really intense. And there was a couple different talks that I did where it was like things like that, but particularly in other countries when I would go and talk that talk, basically. After I did that, I was like, okay, gloves are off.
Yeah.
If you're going to bring me here, this is what you're going to get. And people were calling me because that's what they wanted. You know, going to Germany and having people say, you know, there's less than 9% of the releases that come out in Germany and Austria and Eastern Europe are recordings of women. And like, how do we do this? How do we get in community? And it's like, you know, we're thinking we have it bad here. Like other places in the world are so, you know, I got a letter after I spoke in Australia another time from a woman who is one of like 8 women working in sound in Australia. And she had finally quit after 20 years because she couldn't take it anymore. And she was like working on tours for free because people wouldn't hire women.
Yes. Debilitating.
Yeah.
And
so it's
and you
like
talk
impressive.
About that a lot too.
I do.
Yeah. Yeah. Here
and
now.
That's the whole like.
And it's that talk we need here. Yeah. It's the talk we need in America. We need in Chicago. We need it in our own scene.
Yeah.
And you're right. It also has to be fellas stopping it. And stopping fellas from doing,
yeah,
you
and
know,
it's
horrible.
It's you know, everyone's getting called out largely in Hollywood, and you know, I write about rap, and that's just like a whole. I just to me it feels like a whole other world, other thing. But you know, I don't know.
I mean, I was talking to a journalist that I know and that I've worked with before. Called me last week because he had gotten. He wanted to know if I knew anything about this person that he had gotten a tip about. Bad dude from here and from a scene years ago and he was like, I knew if anybody would know it would be you, and I didn't really know anything, but I offered to kind of check around for him, and he said to me, he's like, you know, my editor was saying that maybe part of the reason there's not as many stories like this breaking in music as everyone knows there should be is because he said because people don't know how to report it, but he said it's also because you're not working, and I just started crying. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of stories that we don't yet know, in part because people don't necessarily know how to tell them, but also it's like, I think it's one thing to tell the story when, like, you're a, you know, powerful white woman in Hollywood or something, or like, yeah. These people are kind of at a remove, and I think something within music is that people have for so long just said this is how it is.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, for decades.
That's it.
That it's really, this yeah. is how that's it is. It. And
it's so deeply ingrained in the culture of, yeah. you know, I mean, like, I mean, you know,
of
rap
the
is a, right, but like all these things are boys clubs, like, you know, yeah. like.
And that you're just, and that you just, I think also once you work in them for so long, you become so Teflon, but also right. you have to compartmentalize to continue to function
yes.
in that space. And so I just keep thinking about a quote I read a few weeks ago where someone was talking about, like, it just feels like the trash compactor is broken. It's just sort of like barfing up all of these memories of all these things that you compartmentalize in yourself. You know, just to be able to be here and function and do this thing that you love or advance your skills or show the world who and how you are or speak your truth or all of these things or be the conduit for other people who are speaking their truth, whether you're as a journalist or a producer or a podcast or, you know, whatever you're doing, that you just learn to kind of like make that part small so that you continue to be here. And I just think it's like, I think that's one of the reasons that we're not seeing quite as much about this in music as we all know.
Yeah, I mean, when we did that talk with Ben Westhoff last year with around his book, mm-hmm. somebody, we did the Q&A and somebody asked me, like, as a woman in rap, you know, how I feel about, you know, hearing misogynistic lyrics or like whatever, and it's like, you can't let that, it affects you so much, but you can't let it, you just gotta keep moving forward, otherwise mm-hmm. I would just be like not able to function, I guess. I don't know. Like, you can't, I don't know. I just can't let that, like you said, Teflon, like, I can't let that touch me.
Mm-hmm. And maybe, I mean, and maybe now we are also in this transition period, hopefully, you know, where not only is it going to be brought to light, but also we can, you know, shift the culture in part because of, I mean, it really in part because of the two of you and you know, many other people who I think demand and insist that we change. You know?
I think the thing that I've, I don't know, I haven't written that much in like the last 2 years, but I've been writing something the last couple of weeks about this, about how the real hard work of this moment isn't like excising these creeps from the scene. Like, that's actually kind of the cosmetic, like, hacking of the diseased limb.
Yeah.
And that the actual hard work is to acknowledge how much the actual hard work in all facets of culture and our life actually is to acknowledge how many of the things that we consume, be it music, movies, clothes, all sorts of things, are built on the suffering and the silence of other people. And that we have to reckon with that, not just at this, like, oh, I'm not going to download this Woody Allen movie or, like, whatever, like, the most basic stuff, or I'm not going to whatever, that it's, like, we really have to look at it. It's not just, you know, I'm not going to support Chris Brown or, like, whatever is the kind of typical knee jerk of that, but that it's, like, but we have to acknowledge how many people have been silenced by the abuses of power. And that's like everywhere from like the Burger King drive-through to what concerts we're going to, whatever, movies we're watching.
Individuals are symptomatic, but we need to address the, you know, system itself that continues to replicate these.
And not rebuild the thing that hasn't served us.
Yeah. Well, you, Jessica Hopper, inspire us.
Yes. And that was like just the surface.
Yeah, no, I know.
Sorry, I detoured out of like, well, I wrote this book.
No, but it's right. but this
but
is what we
really
needed
to
talk
about. Stamps and, you know, getting some change in the mail, you know. Yeah.
So you really do inspire us, and I really want everyone to get your book and to listen to that talk, because it's moving and it's necessary in this moment. I'm wondering what in part inspires you now. Like, who are you rocking with, listening to, reading? You know, what are you inspired by currently?
Ooh, our new question. What is something you slept on that you, like, recently discovered that's just, like, ill?
Ooh. Well, let me start with the like, last couple things that that I really loved is Danez Smith's poetry collection. Mm-hmm. Went and saw Danez and Eve at Women and Children First, it was like, oh, dude, I was a puddle. Yeah. It was so good. And it just made me, oh, man. And also just to see how many people there were, like, really deeply moved by that work. But both Danez and Eve's book, Hanif Abdurraqib's book, of course, is, like, my constant companion, my travel book.
You're a big poetry head.
You know, weirdly enough, yes.
Yeah.
But that Jen Pelly recently wrote a 33 and a third book about the raincoats, and it's really one of the first true, I don't know, it's like a book I've been waiting for my whole life. It's like a true feminist examination that's like such a scholarly deep dive into like a totally overlooked, super influential female band. Mm. And just like, it just feels like to see that happening. I don't want to be like, see that happening in my lifetime, like I'm 70 or something. But the thing that I read today that moved me so much is there's like an incredible interview with Sonny Rollins in Vulture.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, he's so great. But he's talking about like, you know, he basically had to give up playing. And you can tell that it's like the interviewer is maybe sort of being like, but like you're finding peace. He's like, no. No, I'm like, he refuses to be like the chill old guy who's like very sage about that stuff, that he's like, no, I just need to keep playing and learning my whole life. It was very, for anybody who's like making art or writing, like go
check
read that interview.
Out, yeah.
What did I sleep on? Michael Twitty, The Cooking Gene. That book's phenomenal. If you care about cooking and like social histories of cooking, and it's like so fascinating, but it's really about how much of our culinary culture came out of the kitchens, the recipes, the inventiveness of enslaved people in America.
What are you listening to, though?
What am I listening to? I won't, you know, records.
music.
The new Torres record is like really fantastic. I had to listen to the new U2 record like a ton for work. I just produce this U2 thing, and whether I like it or not, the new U2 record's like totally stuck in my head.
Wow. Yes, she works at Spotify. Y'all didn't know.
Don't shout me out. But that, not that I'm like ashamed of it or anything.
That's
like
dope.
That. I don't want to.
And the next time you're on here, we're talking about that because I have so many questions.
Yeah, true.
I try not to associate my opinions with anything. But that, yeah, the Torres record's really good. But I'm just keep listening to that Leanne LaHava song, Green and Gold, over and over like the last couple days. By the way, I made a 4-hour-long mix on Spotify.
Okay.
Of just
what's it called?
Femme
though?
Voices. I put out a monthly mix that's called Discover Weekly, but it's W-E-A-K-L-Y.
Is that go?
But you can find it. This is a super long plug for myself. This is a good Spotify hack. Go to the search tab and put in Spotify : user and then : whatever your friend's username is, but mine is Jesshopp, J-E-S-S-H-O-P-P, and you can listen to my monthly mixes, but this one is 4 hours of women singing.
Let's go. Listen. Where can people find you on the internets otherwise?
At Jesshopp on Twitter. The rest is like, whatever.
Jessica Hopper,
Twitter's
thank you.
Twitter's the only thing that matters.
True. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for rocking
you.
With us, for being
oh
you.
God,
and
this
for
is
next time.
In the world.
Yeah. There's a next time.
Yeah, we'll get a part two at some point.
I'm just going to put this Cheetos Crunchy Flamin' Hot on my face like a feed bag and go to town.
You might not want to get them in like your eyes or your mouth.
Thank you.
Shout out DJ Exist for the beat and Langston Austin for the artwork. The Corner Store is recorded at the WGN Radio Studios and produced by Mike Heideman. I'm Marlena, the co-producer, and I also run social media, so follow us at Shy Corner Store on Twitter and IG.